Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News as we turn our attention to a couple of chefs who, I don't know, it'll be probably hard to get them to talk. They don't like to talk very Oh, man, they like to talk a lot. We're going to be talking about summer cooking a little bit today with them. And they have some ideas maybe about how to make your summer parties or your summer events or maybe your just summer meals with the family great. And Luke Zahm is one of them, one of the guests today. He's James Beard-nominated chef, owner of the Driftless Cafe in Viroqua, and host of a favorite show of mine, Wisconsin Foodie on PBS. Luke, welcome back.
Hey, Larry. It's always so good to be with you and with Patrick. And man, I just want to call out your dedication to telling the stories of Wisconsin and really helping people all around the state really understand themselves and their community members through your work. So it's a tremendous honor to be with you yet again today.
Well, thank you so much for that. And great to have you back. And you mentioned Patrick. Patrick O'Halloran is a Madison-based chef whose ventures have included Lombardino's, the Tipsy Cow Tavern, now executive chef of the Delicious. What's the best way to pronounce that?
It's Delicious-er. It's a little more delicious than delicious.
And we go through this every single time you're on, I think. Delicious-er. It's a spice blending business and, of course, a restaurant. Welcome back. And you're going to be featured in Madison Magazine coming up.
Yeah. I think it hits the newsstands this week, 2026 Chef of the Year. So I really appreciate that. And it was a real team effort to make that happen. And even Luke said some kind words in that article. I just got to read it myself yesterday for the first time. So
I haven't read the article yet, but, you know, I think, you know, they wanted like a pretty small soundbite. And I think I kept that reporter on the phone for probably an hour and a half. So, yeah, I'm glad that it made the cut.
You came off pretty good.
Okay, good.
Nice.
So these are our two guests, and there's probably going to be a lot of laughter and talk as we move along here, and we're going to have a lot of fun talking about food with these two guys. And I hope you'll join in. Give us maybe your go-to meals for a delicious summertime meal, or maybe you've got a question about something that you're interested in preparing, or maybe your favorite ingredients to cook with the kitchen. Give a call to number 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. That's WPR.org. What are your go-to recipes for refreshing early summer meals? We're just getting into that now. I get comments from both of you. Patrick, maybe start with you.
Well, you know, it is asparagus time in Wisconsin, yeah. So that's on the menu right now. We're just going to be starting to get into those snap peas and things like that. I love combining those things with a little bit of a spicy element, some different chilies, but also refreshing notes like fresh mint that will be prolific in gardens across Wisconsin this summer. And then strawberries are right around the corner. So we like to use the strawberries. I'm actually going to be roasting them and using them almost in a savory way.
As roasted strawberry.
Before we get into tomatoes. So, you know, we have our seasons. We got to go with what's here now.
Yeah. Well, what about you, Luke?
Well, you know, being that I'm in one of the most prolific farming areas of the country, I have to echo Patrick's sentiment. Asparagus. I think last week in the Driftless Cafe coolers, Larry, we had about 700 pounds of asparagus dropped. So I am cooking asparagus like my life depends on it. And in some ways, it really does. So this last week, one of the first ones that I always go to is a recipe that I learned from Patrick. It's very simple. It's very subtle and understated, but it's the asparagus milanese. So right now I have two 20-year-old prep cooks actually blanching and shocking the asparagus in the back after the woody ends have been trimmed off. Thank you, sir. And then we'll serve that with a farm fresh duck egg over the top. We'll heat it up a little bit and just that duck egg and the asparagus, and then hit it with a little bit of Sartori Sarvecchio Parmesan cheese that's made in Plymouth, Wisconsin by Sartori. And that is like the hallmark for me of asparagus season. But we've been doing asparagus gazpacho, like all those woody ends. I save those and I'll blanch those off as well and I'll puree it. Last week we featured a little bit of a gazpacho curry that I did with the asparagus ends, a little bit of green curry, and then coconut milk, and had that nice and cool. And then I've been garnishing that recently with a lot of pickled rhubarb. So we also have a ton of rhubarb coming in right now. I'll take it, I'll cut it into like, you know, half inch segments, and then really quick pickle brine, equal parts water and white vinegar. I go heavy on the sugar for that one. And then turmeric and a little bit of mustard seed, fennel seed in there, give it some nuance and depth. And then just pour that hot liquid once it comes to a boil over all that cut rhubarb. And it just accentuates, I mean, it pops springtime. It's the essence of early spring in Wisconsin.
That sounds great. I know last summer we were up in the Driftless cooking at the Owl Farm, and we did a vinaigrette made with an orange-infused olive oil and some of that summer pickled rhubarb, and it was delicious. But to echo your point on the asparagus, so the Milanese, traditionally the French would cook asparagus and serve it with hollandaise sauce and egg and butter sauce.
Yeah.
The Italians in Milan would put a fried egg with olive oil and Parmesan on it. Luke kicked it up by adding the duck egg, which adds that a lot of depth and richness. And it's funny, last night I was just thinking about what I was going to do, and I'm doing a Japanese version of it this week, where I'm going to make a miso and orange zest mayonnaise with the blanched asparagus, and then a jammy egg, kind of like a little bit undercooked hard-boiled egg, and then I'm going to top that with togarashi, which is a Japanese seven spice with chilies, orange zest, and a little bit of sesame, and then we'll put some fresh shiso with it. So we're kind of like taking what we did at Lombardino's 20-plus years ago and moving it out, pushing the borders out.
Boy, you guys are making me hungry already. That sounds wonderful. You know, and here's me. When I've got the asparagus, I'll have a chicken, some breast of chicken, and I'll put a little olive oil on the chicken, and then I'll take my asparagus, and I'll put a little olive oil on the asparagus, and then I'll have some freshly, some Parmesan cheese in a bag, and I'll throw the asparagus in and kind of cover the asparagus. And then I put them both on the grill at the same time. And when the chicken is done, the asparagus is done too.
Well, that's another way. I mean, there's no wrong way to cook, right?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, it always tastes good to me anyway, and my daughters, whoever's with me. Marty in Douglas County has a question. Let's go there. Marty, hi.
Well, Patrick, for crying out loud, you can't talk about roasting strawberries and not tell us how you do it and then what you do with them. So come on, please elaborate. Thank you.
Yes, Jeff.
Well, you know, we're getting ready for the strawberry season to come. Like Luke said, he had 700 pounds of asparagus. When the strawberries come in, they come in for a short time, and we want to get them in as many things as we can. So we were actually thinking we're doing a big dinner coming up in June for the Chef of the Year dinner with some other chefs in town. Sean Farr from the Mint Mark and Evan Daniels from Cadre will be joining me. And I'm going to roast those strawberries, and I'm going to season them with a little bit of olive oil and sumac, and then they will kind of be savory, and the sumac has a tartness, almost like lemon, and that will actually enhance the sweetness of the strawberries. And I'm going to serve that as a savory element along with some tahini and olive oil ice cream and a bittersweet chocolate mousse. So that will be a dessert, but I could also see that going with chicken, with pork. It would be fantastic. In fact, I brought in a bunch of sandwiches for Larry here for lunch.
Yeah.
And on one of them, we take Door County cherries and we cook those down with sugar and mustard seeds and make them into a mostarda, which you could do the same exact thing with a little bit of vinegar with those fresh strawberries. It'd be delicious.
Oh, it sounds great. And so the roasting of the strawberries is...
It's going to add, like, depth of flavor, complexity, and it's going to concentrate all those sugars. So it should be a little bit savory, but it's going to enhance that sweetness. So you get this sweet and savory element.
I'm sure my own... you were going to comment on that, Luke.
I was just really impressed that Chef went through that whole thing, and he managed not to say Maillard reaction once. Go to, like, well, you're looking for the Maillard reaction where you caramelize the sugars. And, kudos to you, sir, for being able to get all the way through it and not say it.
Well, you know, you want the Maillard reaction. You want a little bit of browning, a little color on there, right?
Oh, man. Talking with Patrick O'Halloran, executive chef of the Delicious a spice blending business and restaurant, and Luke Zahm, host of Wisconsin Foodie on PBS and owner of the Driftless Cafe in Viroqua. Questions, comments, or maybe a food experience you want to share with us, I hope you will. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at summertime food preparation, summertime cooking with our guest Patrick O'Halloran, executive chef of the Delicious a spice blending business and restaurant, and Luke Zahn, host of Wisconsin Foodie, PBS, and owner of the Driftless Cafe in Viroqua. We have a few people here online with questions or comments. Let's go to TJ in Madison. TJ, hi.
Hey, hello, you guys. This whole discussion has piqued my memories. When I was young, my mother used to cut really thick slices of a multi-grain bread and toast it. And when it started to get nice and warm, she would bring it out and sprinkle, I hope it was Parmesan, you know, but it was whatever we could get, you know. And then she would toast a little more, and then she would put sliced strawberries on top of it and put it back in and roast it a little bit more. And OMG, I don't know about you guys, but I hope you're drooling, because it was delicious, it was cheap, and we loved it. I'll take your comments off here.
Oh, man. Wow.
Yeah, I think the roasted strawberry would go perfect with cheese. You know, this is the perfect state for that.
Yeah.
That sounds like your mother, the caller's mother, loved him very, very much. I have a kind of a similar experience, you know, with the springtime, early summer foods. My mom used to, we had access to a really nice watercress patch. And my mom would do the same thing. The really crusty, like, you know, nutty bread, you know, a little bit dark. But then we would toast it and then smear cream cheese, which isn't as highbrow as the Parmesan, but then the watercress on there. And it was like that. That for me is one of those food memories, the quintessential early summer, where it's just something very straightforward, light, but really, really delicious.
It sounds wonderful. John in Madison, I believe, has a question. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. I'm a customer at the Delicious, and I noticed that they also have a whole spice business, but I've only really been to the restaurant. Could you ask Patrick about that and what they are doing and how they decided to do that?
Yeah, you know, and I was meaning to, I should have asked that right away, John. Thank you for calling in, because I want these guys both to talk about their businesses. Patrick, go ahead.
So, we had four restaurants between us as an ownership group, the Old Fashioned, the Tipsy Cow Taverns, Lombardino's, of course, and the pandemic hit. And at that moment, I had been with Lombardino's for 20 years, and I was already kind of itching for maybe to do something else. And then we got into this COVID kind of bunker with my wife, my ex-wife, and that's how I became business partners with wife, ex-wife, daughter working for me. And Luke's shaking his head there because he loves this story. So what we did was cancel a bunch of trips that we had planned to go around the world, and we had all this unexpected time off that we had never had. So we started cooking our way around the world, and that led us to the world of spice blends. So that was kind of my COVID rabbit hole. And then our friends who own Bunkies, they make hummus on the east side of Madison, had a little tiny kitchen in the basement, and they let me use that space, and I developed the first 12 spice blends. And we went with the name Delicious because it's something I would always tell cooks over the years that came through the kitchen, that people can make delicious food at home, but if we want them to get off the couch and drive over here and pay us good money, our food has to be Delicious So that's how that name kind of came about. So we started with 12 spice blends, and then we moved into our current location on the Near East Side here in Madison in the former Greyhound bus station, and we built a restaurant space, and we have a spice lab where we actually produce, hand toast, grind, and blend all these spices in small batches by hand, and then we cook with them in an open kitchen. We have a little communal seating, an outdoor patio. We do lunch and dinner. We do special events. We do private events. All kinds of things, but it kind of moved me away from the restaurants, which I sold out of, and now I'm focused on spices, and we have 58 blends and 9 more in production. We just launched burgers with our new Better Butter Burger spice blend, which has actual Wisconsin butter powder in it. So I like to go down the rabbit hole of the origin of how foods moved around the planet, how the colonial powers interacted, and how we got where we are today with all these flavors that we've come to love.
Oh, it's an amazing story. And you brought me, you have different groupings.
Yeah, different collections. So I brought you the Wisconsin collection as a little retirement gift, which has Taste Like Victory, which is our green and gold blend that Luke and I kind of spearheaded that. I kind of think Luke came up with the name for that when we were kind of spitballing it for the Vince Lombardi Cancer Foundation dinner. So it's green and gold with green hatch chilies and sweet onions and turmeric. And then the sister to that is Jump Around with shallots and red chilies. Supper Club Steak Rub, which is our perfect Wisconsin steak rub. And then we have Deer Camp, which is great on fish and venison. And it goes far beyond that. It's great on anything with a lot of ginger and some licorice root, which is absolutely amazing when it's cooked. People just love it.
Oh, well, I can't wait to dive into that. I tell you, let's turn to Luke. Luke, you've got Wisconsin Foodie going on PBS, of course, Wisconsin PBS and other PBS networks, as a matter of fact. Talk about that, but I also want you to talk about your Driftless Cafe.
Yeah, this is perhaps the most intense season for me. So the Driftless Cafe, you know, people might know, like, we are located in Viroqua, Wisconsin, Vernon County. It has the second highest concentration of organic farms in any county in the United States of America. So the menu here is constantly shifting and changing. Patrick taught me when I was a very young line cook, when we were working together at Lombardino's, to maybe look at the culinary world through the lens as if we were Italians living in the upper Midwest. And what that did for me, being a kid from Lafarge, Wisconsin, is it was almost like a free invitation to really start paying attention to what the local farmers and food producers around me were curating and bringing into the world. So the Driftless Cafe is a way to put a spotlight on a lot of those farmers and food production entities in Wisconsin that, you know, maybe you interact with when you go to the farmer's market, or you might see it in the shelves of the local co-op or your grocery store. But I really wanted to give something to people that they could come to the Driftless region and have this dynamic dining experience that is constantly evolving and changing. The gardens are in right now at the Owl Farm. Larry, I can't tell you how many times over the past couple weeks, I'm quoting Larry Mueller quotes from your radio show and the garden talk as I'm planting this thing out. This year, I went a little ham. I had to do some raised bed tomatoes. You know, I'm in the process of remediating the soil. I have a black walnut tree that hangs right over my garden. So I'm working with a local biochar company We're putting a lot of biochar actually into the garden soil in an effort to draw out some of those toxins, but then really being specific about where we plant and how we plant. The Owl Farm is this very small outdoor dining experience that's all wood fired. We seat about 24 people out there, and it's actually adjacent to my wife and my business partner's home. So it is going from transactional dining, which is what a lot of restaurant culture is. We're trying to take it transformational. And what that really does for me is it allows me to tell stories. And that's what Wisconsin Foodie has produced and done a really good job of in the longevity, is telling the stories of the people who are producing our food. We're starting to go on the road for that again. I've already been up in the UP and Door County this year. I've been in Stevens Point. You know, like, we're constantly shaking and moving because the stories of our prolific agricultural, you know, movement here in Wisconsin are always changing, and it's ever present. So that, you know, it occupies a little bit of my time. we're running around. We've had, Arthur, the executive producer, he's been doing site locations and scouts. We're going to tie in one of Patrick and my longtime friends and farmers, Scott Williams, into an episode this year. So you'll see us around Madison here in the next couple weeks. But, you know, we're just following the old farmer's wisdom, making hay while the sun shines.
Kelly, that sounds great. Kelly emailed us. She and her husband are both vegetarian. Last summer, they bought a pellet grill. It's been fun grilling the usual, potatoes, Brussels sprouts, Impossible burgers, etc. But that can get boring after a while, Kelly says. Could you give us some ideas for other things they might cook on the grill?
What do you think, Luke? I always go to, I love cauliflower steaks on the grill, and they take to spices, they take to olive oil really well. I'm a huge lover of eggplant on the grill. Of course, I don't know if they mentioned mushrooms, doing like maitake mushrooms or getting oyster mushrooms in when they're in their whole kind of clump together. You can grill them as like big chunks, so you're not chasing individual mushrooms all over your grill. What do you think, Luke?
Yeah, so lately, Patrick, and this is not any sort of call to action, but it is a ringing endorsement. I've been taking the Deliciouser's Bomba Spice, and with oyster mushrooms specifically, because oyster mushrooms are an invasive species in Wisconsin. We get them a lot in the hardwood forests around us here in the southwestern part of the state, but I know that they're fairly prolific all over. Using olive oil and hitting it with that bomba spice and letting it marinate. You know, I usually let those oyster mushrooms sit overnight with a little bit of salt on them. And as you know, mushrooms are almost, I mean, they're like 98% water. Mm-hmm. So the salt in the bomba spice really pulls out some of that moisture. And to the effect of the strawberries, like, you put that on the grill, you get those nice crispy tips. You get like all the aromatics and the fennel and the Calabrian chilies and that bomba spice. And it really becomes something that is much larger than the sum of its parts. I can't sing the praises of that spice blend loud enough. It's just, it's delicious.
Oh, it's delicious-er.
It's delicious-er. There it is. And now the name makes sense.
Oh, well, this may be the last time I ever mention it on the show, but I've mentioned it many times when it comes to grilling, and that is beets.
Oh, yeah. Smoky beets so good.
Hamburger beets.
They are so good.
And it's like we were talking about with the strawberries. If you put those on a grill low and slow and let them go, you're intensifying all those sugars in there and really sweetening them up. But then they have that roasted vibe going. So it's like hits you in the front of the palate and the back.
Yeah. I just, Mad Dog and Merrill prepared some for me once, and I thought beets, you know, and there were other vegetables, and they said, well, those will be the first vegetable. The beets will be the first thing gone. And I had never tried it. This is some years back. And I had a couple. I thought, oh, I got to go back and get some more of those beets. They were all gone.
Yeah. We just did a dish on our menu over the early spring where we roasted beets. And after they were roasted tender, we put them in a dehydrator for about 6 hours, which changes the texture. It makes it almost like a steak. So then when people order it, we would sear it in a pan with some olive oil, add in some thyme and garlic, and then butter baste it and serve it as if it were a steak because it changes the texture, but it has that sweetness and that complexity of a great steak.
Oh, that sounds yum is right. Kim in Eau Claire has something. Let's go there. Hi, Kim. Thanks for calling.
Hi, guys. How are you? And Larry, I'm heading to Port Washington, so when you retire, come on, jump in the boat. You got my number.
I got your number, Kim.
Yeah. Anyhow, so I've been cooking salmon on the grill for a long time, and specifically I like cohos because to me they're not quite as strong of a fish flavor as like the king or the chinooks. So, but this year I switched it up and I stuffed it with crab and cream cheese on the grill with a smoke stick to slow cook it and smoke it, and then maple syrup on top.
Wow. I love it. Yeah, I love it.
Sounds awesome.
Oh, man.
You are speaking the love language of my executive chef at the cafe. He will sneak cream cheese into just about anything if I'm not careful and really watching it. But, you know, it, you're right. It is like this totally binding ingredient set that you can put into something like that. And I always find when I'm grilling salmon, I need to add fat, right? Because it's really easy to cook the fat out of a piece of fish, specifically if it's a wild caught fish. So, you know, like the cream cheese, that kind of speaks to something my aunt who lives in Anchorage, Alaska, taught me. They like to put a little bit of an aioli or a mayo base on their salmon before they put it on the grill. And it acts as this liaison. You can load it with herbs. You could load it with cream cheese. You could load it with crab or, you know, even maple. But just adding a little bit of fat to that really brings out a lot of the flavors of that fish. Oh, Hal, what do you got?
Yeah, I mean, we have a recipe on our website for a salmon, and we take Greek yogurt. I like to put a little bit of lemon, maybe a little bit of garlic, and some olive oil, whip that together, and then spread that over the top of the salmon before you grill it or roast it. Then when it comes out of the oven, sprinkle that with za'atar and then a really nice, healthy glug of your best quality olive oil, maybe some fresh lemon, some dill, parsley, mint over the top. So it goes a little bit Mediterranean, but it's the same effect as the cream cheese where you're putting that layer of that fat between the cooking, you know, the roasting and the top of the fish. And on one other note with cream cheese, for some reason I was thinking about grilling pizza. And back in the late 80s, early 90s, I used to order takeout from Pizza Man in Milwaukee, and we would get a pepperoni, green olive, and cream cheese pizza, which was fantastic. Little dollops of cream cheese on pizza will blow your mind.
I'm going to try that.
It's really good.
I never even thought of that.
Just slow acquiescence into like,
What can't you put cream cheese on?
I don't know.
In fact, one time at Lombardino's, we brought in some bagels and cream cheese for the staff, and we had this cook, Brian. Luke knows who I'm talking about. And he put a whole 8-ounce brick of cream cheese between a bagel, and someone said, "That's too much cream cheese." And he said, "That there's no such thing as too much cream cheese."
Oh, man. Well, Patrick O'Halloran and Luke Zahm are guests today, and you can join in, too. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Bruno in Sturgeon Bay called, couldn't stay with us. He loves cooking with springtime morel mushrooms. How much do each of you use morels in your cooking? Patrick, you want to start?
Well, I think Luke probably uses them more than I do, but I've had some access to them, you know, through the markets here. In the spring, you know, they are delicious. A little bit cost prohibitive for a lot of people, but but you know, they pair so well with butter. So you got to add butter to those over a little bit of like rustic toasted bread. And then we have a smoked sea salt called Pacific Smoke. It's alderwood smoked. So I like to add that little bit of smokiness to it, which actually gives it a little bit of a grilled vibe to it. But also you could, you know, take those mushrooms and stuff them with cream cheese and roast them. Little maple syrup and butter.
Ooh.
You're good to go.
Crab in there. Yeah. It doesn't matter.
Oh, man. Well, can you top that, Luke, or have you got another approach?
You know, when it comes to, like, some of those staple ingredients, like morels, right, it is quintessentially an upper Midwestern thing. Obviously, you can get morels, like, in Missouri and in different parts of America, but, like, I don't think that they quite revere them as much as we do. My wife would probably, you know, end this entire situation now if I prepared her something other than morels gently sauteed in butter. I like to brown that butter first, right? Mm-hmm. So going back to Patrick O'Halloran's words of wisdom, you really get that Maillard reaction going with that brown butter.
Get
so
that
it's
nuttiness.
Nutty and delicious. But like, you know, there's just something about those morels once they get, again, that crispy edges on them. Holy smokes, those are good. And it doesn't take very many of them to set off a dish. Like, you really need to capture that essence because from what I hear, what the old timers are telling me, we don't get morel mushrooms like we used to. You know, it's just not that way anymore. And I don't know exactly why. I think there's a lot of competing arguments about that. But, you know, savoring those morels while we've got them, I think that that's my go-to.
I was thinking back to my dentist, this is many years back, was telling me a little story about getting a call from one of his clients. She said, I've got all these mushrooms in the back of my lawn, and I don't know what they are. Would you mind coming and taking a look? And he said it was like this whole huge patch of morel mushrooms that somehow sprouted up. And she said, well, I don't want them, so you can have them. So he had a grocery bag, you know, one of the regular big grocery bags. He filled it full and then another bag, almost full, and took them home.
Nice.
And, and he said he waited expectantly for the next year to come around. And when she came in, she said, no, I didn't get any of those. Good enough, I didn't get any, so she didn't want them anyway.
Yeah, those stories always make me so sad. I've never once stumbled into like that multi-pound patch of morels, but I hear about it. You know, like, oh, I walked into this one patch and found 20 pounds or whatever it is. It's just, I think it's becoming increasingly rare.
It's like Bigfoot, a Bigfoot
sighting.
It's
like Bigfoot, exactly.
I don't even know what they cost this year on the market. In the farmer's market, sometimes you'll see them, but why?
You know, they're always in the $30 a pound plus, you know, everything in that is wild forage, there's so much time and effort that goes into it and knowledge by the people that are out foraging for those things because you can't grow them domestically.
No.
Another thing that came to mind is, you know, it's grilling season. So a nice pork chop or a piece of beef on the grill, you take those morels, saute them up in the butter and in true Wisconsin fashion, flame up a little Korbel brandy, add a little good cream. And you have a really simple cream sauce that will be great with anything off the grill.
Mm. James in Langlois County has something for us. James, I think it relates to morels. James?
That last recipe sounded great. But I got one for you, and I got to attribute this to my buddy Max. So you have to find rice flour, and you make a seltzer batter with a few spices, so it's real thin, and you shallow fry them in canola or peanut oil. And I'm telling you guys, Luke, this is going to be on the television program. It'll blow people away. You get the whole caramelized thing, and we made some this weekend, and I've never seen people actually get giddy over food like that. But yeah,
yeah, that sounds fantastic. You're kind of whipping up like a nice tempura batter, so you get nice and crispy, and brings out all those delicious flavors. We're doing that on our menu right now with the maitake mushrooms, doing that kind of batter and serving it in a little mushroom broth that goes with it.
Oh, sounds wonderful. James, thank you so much. Mike and Madison will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Mike.
Good afternoon, guys. I got a comment for the vegetarian folks that like to grill. As a former vegetarian who went back to eating meat because I love venison and I like my hunting and fishing. But one thing, you can, any vegetable on the grill is better grilled. All your asparaguses and everything, you sliced cauliflower, you name it. But one thing you can add to that is you can candy up some of those vegetables. You can also add, I like to take a little brown sugar or white sugar, brown sugar with a little bit of pineapple juice and mix that together and brush that on your vegetables like a zucchini, and then you grill those, and then you've got a little sweet candied vegetables to put on salads or anything else. Works out great. And then grilling fruit, you can grill all sorts of different kinds of fruit, and one that I like for vegetarians, as a former vegetarian, what I like in my salads is Macintosh green apples. Slice those up in the quarter slices, put them on the grill, and then dice them up and put it in your salad, or take some strawberries, have them, put them on the grill, give them a little bit of grilling on the strawberries, and throw that in your salad, and it just gives a little bit of smoky strawberry-ness to your salad. Oh, so many good options for summertime grilling.
I love it.
Yeah, sounds great.
Yeah.
Have you ever done that?
Well, yeah, you know, and I would not to one-up Mike here, but I would say with that kind of marinating them, one of the really simple hacks that we do here at the cafe, one of our vinaigrettes, it's called maple balsamic, and it's literally equal parts balsamic vinegar to maple syrup. And it's a very simple salad dressing, but it does the kind of the same thing, right? I don't have to re-emulsify it. I don't have to melt that sugar down at all. It's already all in that maple syrup. And just brushing that on those grilled vegetables, I mean, it changes. Like, we have people come up to us at the cafe and be like, wow, it tastes like, I don't know how you do it. It's like the salads are candy. Well, in fact, they kind of are, depending on your definition of candy. So, I love that idea.
So balsamic vinegar, half and half with maple syrup.
That's it. Maple balls. You just made it, Larry. This is my contribution to the News Hour with Larry Mueller, is giving away one of my staple salad dressings at the restaurant.
Oh, man. Luke Zahm and Patrick O'Halloran, our guest, questions for them or maybe an experience to share. We've had some great calls and emails. You can join in 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking summertime cooking with Patrick O'Halloran and Luke Zahm. Thank you both for being with us, and thank you for listening in today. Again, questions or comments, the number is 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@WPR.org. Grant emailed us. One of his favorite ways of using asparagus is to slice the spears, saute the pieces in olive oil with a pinch of salt until just tender, then use all of this purees it in a yeast bread recipe along with some extra virgin olive oil in the dough. No other liquids are used in the dough.
Whoa. Just using all the vegetable particulate. I was just talking with the chef about that. That's kind of the modern way of making sauces and things. Since we are now living in the gluten-free world, we don't thicken things with flour and glutinous matter anymore. We thicken things with the vegetables themselves. And that's what gives us those thick, rich, creamy purees.
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever heard, like, what's the technical definition of that? Somebody told me a long time ago it was farinaceous. By adding that vegetable matter into the sauce, that's as a thickening liaison. But yeah, we do a lot of that too. It also fortifies the flavor.
Yeah, I've been watching some things on YouTube where these chefs in Europe are talking about the mother sauces that have been around for over 200 years are no longer what modern chefs are using. We're not thickening everything with flour. It's not as heavy. We're doing a lot more with vinaigrettes. Like, for instance, the simple vinaigrette you just heard about to add depth of flavor. We're doing a lot more with those purees with vegetables. Cooking is kind of evolving. I guess we're moving forward.
Somebody else is wondering, what's the best way to heat or cook veggies on the grill? Is it direct or indirect heat?
I think it really depends on what your end goal is. Like, you could wrap beets in foil, put them in a kind of a cooler part of the grill and let them go for a really slow and low kind of thing. But if I was doing asparagus or something, I might go on a much hotter part of the grill because I love that little bit of char that adds that texture. It adds that excitement, the pop of smoke. So it really depends on the vegetable as well. Like, carrots sweeten up on the grill, but because they are fibrous and a little bit thicker, I might go in the slower range and then finish them on a hotter part of the grill to get that coloring that Luke likes to refer to with a Maillard reaction.
Well, I like how it's mine now.
I think I said that one time. It stuck with me.
All right.
So in the case of Larry's chicken breast, with the Parmesan cheese and the asparagus, would you go direct or indirect with the asparagus?
Well, if I wanted them to be done at the same time, I would go indirect because I think that asparagus is going to be overcooked by the time that chicken breast hits where we need it to be. So I might, move that. It's so hilarious. I just watched someone do a sheet pan dinner of pork chops and asparagus, and there's no way those things were cooked together at the same time when they came out of the oven.
Yeah, actually, that's kind of what I do.
That's Larry's technique right there.
Yeah, there it is. I know. We called it
a little indirect.
Oh man!
Because you want them to be a little crunch.
But if you're going to do it in the oven on a sheet pan, put the chicken to the back of the oven, which is the hotter part of the oven, and the vegetables towards the front, and then hopefully they cook at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if everybody knew that.
I don't know.
The heat is in the back of the oven.
Well, you know, ovens are all finicky. They all have their hot spots, but generally, yeah, they're going to be hotter towards the back.
Yeah. And if my oven says 350 degrees, it's actually 360 degrees. So I have, if I need to do something at 300, if I really want it at 350 degrees, I put it at about 345 degrees. I guess we all learn our ovens.
Yeah.
You guys, what kind of ovens do you guys use?
Ooh.
At home or in the restaurant, we have these. I have a 10 burner range. It's South Bend is the brand commercial. Then we have a large convection oven by a company called South Bend as well, I think that one is. But it's a huge convection oven that we roast most things in, so that convection air kind of heats things faster and cooks more evenly all around inside of that oven. And then we do have also a charcoal grill. It's a little Japanese charcoal grill, so we're doing all of our meats and fish and chops over a direct charcoal grill. But again, we keep a hot spot in the back and a cooler spot in the front. So you're always monitoring where you want things to get the right amount of char. There's a difference between perfectly seared and burnt. Or as my old chef Scott Shelley used to say, when it's smoking, it's cooking. When it's burnt, it's done.
Luke, what about you?
Oh, Larry. Well, I've got a stone deck oven in the cafe. And the cafe, like we know, we have that thing cranked up to about 500, 550 degrees. So again, like all the vegetables go in the front. The big stuff that you want to really push goes in the back. We get a lot of, residual cooking off that stone floor. But then also I have a few wood fired ovens. Last night I was doing pizza. My 20-year-old son is home from college, and he decided he wanted to take a foray into working with me at the cafe. it's been glorious. I will say it's been one of the true achievements of my lifetime to be able to pass some of this knowledge to my kids. And so we had that oven up at 950 degrees. You know, and I got it there in about 2.5 hours, which is good. But we also have a wood burner here at the cafe. And so I can get that really high heat, get it in there very quickly. You know, it takes all of 90 seconds to cook a whole pizza on that wood-fired oven. But vegetables in there, like, you know, as Patrick was saying, if you cook them indirectly first and then you finish in that high heat, I mean, you can crank out endless amounts of food and varieties of it in those two arrangements. So that's pretty much what I've got going on here. And for me, as much live fire as I can, if I can possibly manipulate into a cooking experience, that's where I live.
Well, that makes me think about the vegetarian cooking again. Last summer, I was lucky enough to do a dinner with Luke at the Owl Farm, and we took large leaves of Swiss chard. And this is something I saw in Mexico. And we brushed them with a little oil, laid them on pans, and then put some Oaxacan string cheese in there and put them in that wood-burning oven just till all of the leaves started to char and crisp. And then you fold it over, and what you've essentially made is a vegetarian quesadilla without a tortilla. But it was such an intense flavor and so delicious. And it was a technique I experienced in Oaxaca, Mexico, and I really wanted to bring that back. And it's a really fun way to use all those greens that are really prolific in our gardens later in the summer.
When we're wondering, how are we going to, what can I do differently? I've got all of this produce here. How am I going to make it a little different? And cheese comes in, you know, here we got June Dairy Month.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're working with your son and it's going well.
It's going really well. I'm actually a little bit of afraid how well it's going, honestly. We're 2 weeks in now. And, you know, we've got a pretty intense and robust schedule here. But the thing that I was worried about is the being able to, like, hang for the hours in the kitchen, you know, because it's not a you show up, you do the thing, you go home really quick. It's a process. So Benny has really adapted well to the grind. What's really amazing about it, and now he won't shut up about the restaurant and, like, cooking and, like, you know, he's asking me all these questions like, what is it like to work at Alinea? I'm like, I don't know. I work for O'Hale. the really beautiful part today, in fact, at 6 p.m., I have all these young cooks who have come in and they're doing a fantastic job. One of the things that they often forget is to season in layers, right? We want to make sure that there's seasoning every step of the process. So they often skip the salt and just assume they can add it at the end. Well, today we are going to cement that into their developing frontal lobes. We're all going over to the tattoo shop at 6 p.m. and Luke is buying everyone a tattoo that's cooking at the cafe.
Wow.
And is young, and it just says salt right on their wrist. So it's gonna be a good time.
That's awesome, because I've been working with my daughter for the last year at The Deliciouser, and we're going to hopefully ship her up to you for a couple events this summer to get broaden her, you know, breadth of experience. And we're doing something similar. It's not tattoos. I'm going to take the whole kitchen staff down to Chicago for dinner to celebrate the Chef of the Year honor that we received, because it's really, you do it with the team. It's not one chef. You're nothing without the team. I've had a similar experience working with my daughter. It's been just really great seeing how her mind works. And all of it kind of came to her naturally as a restaurant baby, you know, growing up in it.
Well,
I will say Saturday, I had my 13-year-old son, Silas, on salads. I had my 20-year-old son, Benjamin, on the pizza station. And then I have another, like, adopted son, Carson, on the hotline. And then it was me and the executive chef. And, like, watching these kids kind of do this whole thing together. And Silas, my 13-year-old, is the sleeper. That kid has grown up in the restaurant. He hasn't known any life away from the restaurant. So he is a monster. I sent Trevor over, the executive chef, at one point in the service to just make sure that Silas had his knees together. He was okay. And immediately, Silas just shot me the nastiest look. Like, dude. And I was like, all right, slow your roll, okay?
And on that note, we're definitely out of time. Patrick, Luke, it's been a joy talking with you guys over the years. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us. It's such a pleasure. I hope someone keeps the torch going of food talk here at WPR.
Yeah, it will be. Patrick O'Halloran of the Deliciouser, Luke Zahn of the Driftless Cafe in Viroqua, our guests. Of course, Luke is also with Wisconsin Foodie on PBS. I'm Larry Mueller.